Connie looked on our past itinerary yesterday and discovered that it's been 9 years since we were here. One of my joys, in fact, I'll put a little pebble of joy there, is to be back in North Georgia. We love this part of the world. We're actually staying for 2 months up in Big Canoe, about an hour north of here. Not much has changed in the last 9 years, right? If you think the last 10 years, there's been a lot of change. The next 10 years portend even greater change, I suggest. So I actually have two titles to this sermon this morning: Widening Our Circle of Compassion and Reality 101. I want to offer three main points. I mean, you know, every sermon's supposed to have 3 points, right? So I've got 3 points, but they're kind of odd. They're a little weird. Just came up with them yesterday, and so I'm actually going to read them because they're so odd that I might not have remembered them. The shape of time and the nature of joy and fulfillment. The shape of time and the nature of joy and fulfillment. Second point. The color of God and the purpose of religion and science. The color of God and the purpose of religion and science. And the third, the way of life and the necessity of humility and gratitude. The way of life and the necessity of humility and gratitude. So, first, what do I mean by the shape of time? Well, there are four major ways that human beings, and just to let you know where I'm coming from, I'm a religious naturalist. I have no supernatural or otherworldly beliefs, but I do value religious mythic language because it can speak the language of relationship more potently than most secular forms of language. So I freely use religious language, but I always mean it in a this world, undeniably realistic kind of way. So my creed, in a nutshell, is this: reality is my God, evidence is my scripture. The epic of evolution is my creation story, ecology is my theology. Integrity is my spirituality, and fostering a just and healthy future is my mission. So I share that just so you know where I'm coming from. Because I don't want there to be misunderstanding when I use words like God, for example. Which I mean reality, reality with a personality, not a person outside reality. But first, let's talk about the shape of time. So the four main ways that human beings have experienced time depend almost entirely on what kind of culture they lived in. For the first 98% of human history, from roughly 2.5 million years ago, if you start with Homo habilis, walking upright and using stone tools, that's about 2.5 million years ago. If you start then, until about maybe 10,000 years ago, actually about probably 7,000 or 8,000 years ago, human beings lived more or less sustainably. That is, they lived more or less in a way that didn't diminish or destroy or defile primary reality. In other words, everything we depend upon. Soil, forest, water, life, other species. Now, it does turn out that when human beings invent a new technology that serves them, it can be problematic for other species. For example, when we invented spears and spear throwers that we could kill at a distance. This was the first time any animal in Earth's history could kill at a distance. So whenever human beings first showed up in Madagascar and Cuba and Australia and North America, all the big mammals go out. So then they needed to learn to live indigenously. That is, they learned to live sustainably. But for the first 98% of human history, time was experienced almost in a sense of eternity. In other words, there wasn't the sense that things were getting better and better. There wasn't the sense that things were getting worse and worse. There wasn't the sense of things are just repeating the same pattern. There was this almost an ahistorical or a non-historical sense. In other words, every culture was responsible. The most sacred of all obligations was to honor the past and to express your obligations to the past by passing on their wisdom about how to live sustainably to the future. So it was passing on the wisdom of the past to the future and doing so with as much perfection or non-changing as possible. And technologies didn't evolve much during that time because you basically had very sustainable forms of technology. And again, this begins to shift when we domesticate fire and can begin using fire for a whole bunch of reasons, and then spears. So those were the first two technologies after speech. Verbal symbolic speech, where words point to something beyond what they can capture, is the first technology that we developed that began to separate us from the living world, the natural world. We began to get to the place where we could overpower some of the constraints that the living world provides on all species. See, living sustainably, it turns out, the fundamental requirement is to honor limits. So the first shape of time is this sense that time really doesn't exist or doesn't change. What has been passed on to you, you faithfully as possible pass it on to the future. Then what happened about 7,000 or 8,000 years ago, we started mining metals and started mining minerals and creating weapons and tools, which created this arms race between various cultures. And this is where we begin to see technological development. We start seeing what gets called, it's not even history yet, because most people have thought of history as when we begin writing and start a recorded history. Of course, it's historical. But we see this sense of time as more rhythmic patterns. We see the rise and fall of civilizations over time. In fact, when writing develops about 5,000 years ago, we start seeing lots of civilizations and cultures rise and fall. So the shape of time in expanding civilizations, expanding societies, that is where we're taking resources from the living world, fresh resources, like that haven't been defiled, and we're exuding waste to the living world because every species takes from its environment and exudes to its environment. And as long as it honors limits, usually checked by other species, that can happen for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. That's what the nature of sustainability is. But in societies that are taking more resources than the population can be sustained, or their population grows to where they get in what's called overshoot, they overshoot the carrying capacity of the living world, societies become great, and then their own greatness becomes their own undoing, and then they collapse. And we know of roughly 32 civilizations, city-based civilizations, that have become great over 2 to 4 or 5 centuries, and then over 1 or 2 centuries collapsed. And we say collapse, it's not like this. I mean, even Rome, we talk about the collapse of the Roman Empire, it took 325 years. It was a stair step. And then there were partial recoveries. That's the way most of these cultures and civilizations contracted over a long period of time. So the shape of time in expanding times, when there's more than enough resources for the population, there's that sense that everything is getting better and better. That's where we start seeing this concept of progress emerging, that things are progressing. We've got it better than our parents. They had it better than their parents. Our kids will have it better than us. So this sense of progress and expansion is integral to virtually every civilization that is in what's called carrying capacity surplus. There's more than enough resources. The problem or the challenge is that when you reach peak and then you start denuding the forests and the soil goes away and you've overshot the carrying capacity, you have too many people, then you start contracting and it happens again about twice as fast as expansion. So people who live in the declining times of civilizations, the declining times of empires, the declining times of cultures, societies, they live with a sense of time that things are getting worse and worse. Because that's their experience. They had it worse than their parents had it worse than theirs, and their kids are probably going to have it worse than they did. That doesn't mean horrible, it just means challenging. And then for the long periods of dark ages in between civilizations, there's a sense of stability. There's again the sense, but those who know history, especially literate cultures, they recognize there have been previous civilizations. So the shape of time in most dark ages is a sense of rhythmic, not necessarily circular. It doesn't come back to the same place, but like a spiral. You know, it comes, but it keeps coming back. So we see the rise and fall of civilizations. We see the decline of cultures. So the most challenging time, it turns out, is when people were born into expanding times, but then it shifts in their lifetime, and then they're living in declining times. In other words, the stuff, the energy, it turns out energy is primary. The energy that's used is less good. It's more expensive. It's more harmful to the environment. And the resources are less quality. And if you're alive during that time, it's really challenging to make the mental and the heart and the expectational shift from expanding possibilities when liberal values predominate because the pie's bigger, to contracting times when people's in-group tightens up, schisms are there, blame game, scapegoating, and so conservative values predominate in contracting societies. And of course, everybody in this room has been living in that shift. Now, many people still don't believe that we are in decline, because one of the most common things that we see is denial. It turns out denial is a very healthy, normal, some would even say necessary coping mechanism. So how to stay inspired? So this is what I mean by the shape of time and the nature of joy and fulfillment. It turns out that there are human universals that are true for all humans at all times in every culture. And I want to share a list of these that Dave Pollard, who's a blogger, a friend and colleague, he took the scholarship from a number of different scholars and said, here are eight universals that seem to be true for every human in every culture. Eight basic human needs. Number one, the need to belong to and connect with a safe and engaging community, starting with attachment to mother in the first critical years of life. Two, the need for meaning and purpose in one's life, including meaningful work. Three, the need to be valued, appreciated, and heard. Four, the need to be optimistic or hopeful about the future for oneself and one's loved ones. Five, the need for control and a degree of autonomy over one's life and one's work. Six, the need to be regularly and closely in touch with primary reality, the living world, the natural world. Seven, the need for a sense of home and place. And eight, the need for freedom from chronic stress, financial, physical, whatever, and the time and space to recover from stress, including getting adequate sleep. Now, one of the most interesting things to note about that list is that in traditional, stable, sustainable cultures, all of them were met in spades. And in modern Western, not just Western, but industrial civilization, most of them are not met. And it becomes challenging to meet some of them. And of course, when basic needs, remember Maslow's hierarchy? When basic needs are not being met, dysfunctions show up. Depression, hoarding, blaming, addiction of all kinds, and a numbing out, an inability to care. In fact, the title of his blog was Cultural Acedia, A-C-E-D-I-A, Cultural Acedia, when we can no longer care. So coming back to this, the nature of joy and fulfillment, the nature of joy and fulfillment, whether you live in expanding times or contracting times or stable times, turns out there are just a sort of a basic handful of things that allow us to live a great life, to have healthy relationships, to die a peaceful death, and to leave a sweet legacy. It's not an infinite number of things that allow us to live a great life, have healthy relationships, die a peaceful death, and leave a sweet legacy. So coming to this next thing, the color of God and the purpose of religion and science. Now, Again, what I'm meaning by God is reality with a personality. And it turns out that one of the defining characteristics between sustainable cultures and unsustainable cultures is around the color of God. If your culture believes that God is merely invisible, it's unsustainable. If your culture believes that God, that is the divine, however the divine was conceptualized, is blue, green, and brown, that is part of the ecosphere, embodied, revealed, expressed, incarnate in the living world, then your culture can be sustainable. We don't know of a single sustainable culture anywhere in human history that didn't relate to what we would call in secular language the ecosphere or the biosphere in a holy, in an I-thou way rather than an I-it way. The famous Jewish theologian Martin Buber said basically that we cannot survive, our species cannot survive by having an I-it relationship to primary reality, only an I-thou, relating to nature as a thou, relating to the cosmos as a thou. And see, this doesn't require otherworldlyism. Prayer is not praying to some magical being up there out there. That's a trivial notion of prayer. Prayer is the posture and attitude of humility and gratitude. When I get on my knees, as I often do at awesome places, and raise my hands, I have no otherworldly or supernatural beliefs. I'm in the posture and attitude of humility and gratitude. It's cherishing life and the holiness, the sacredness of life. In fact, one of the things I was going to say is a quote. I'll say it now because I consider it scripture. Wendell Berry said, "There are no unsacred places. There are only sacred places and desecrated places." So, some of us in this room probably don't feel comfortable with God talk, and that's fine. But for those of us that do, our God better be brown, green, and blue. That is, the biosphere, the ecosphere must be related to as divine. Otherwise, we're part of the problem rather than part of the solution. And the purpose of religion and science, this is the interesting thing. When you look at the whole history of humanity, turns out religion is primarily about ensuring that the future is never compromised by the present. The fundamental role in healthy, sustainable, stable societies, I'll be saying a lot more about this at my 1 o'clock program, but the fundamental role of religion historically in healthy cultures has been to basically ensure accountability to the future. That we have an obligation to the past to honor everything that's made this moment possible. That's why I loved in the order of service, all the different elements of the order of service really work together. But this chalice lighting is just so perfect because it's all about that honoring and obligation to past, present, and future. And that's the role of religion. In fact, if religion isn't ensuring accountability to the future, it's failing in its most fundamental role. That's why I used to say that religion is asleep at the wheel, but it's worse than that. Half of religion is gagged and tied in the trunk, and the other half of religion is in the back seat cheering on the psychopathic politicians that are driving us over the cliff. So religion needs to have a born-again experience. Religion needs to be saved for our species to have any hope of redemption. Again, I'm using religious language here, obviously, but what I'm meaning is religion has to come home to reality. And then finally, the role of science. Turns out that science is absolutely necessary for helping us to understand the nature of reality that religion is supposed to help us live in right relationship to. That's why I say evidence is modern-day scripture. The global scientific community, that is, you've got Buddhist scientists, Christian scientists, atheist scientists, free thinker scientists, Hindu scientists, all contributing to the collective intelligence of our species. And that needs to be valued above old men and old books. Now, I know I'm speaking to the choir here, but this is probably news to some of your neighbors and your family. That's why I call the three most pernicious forms of religious idolatry are idolatry of the written word, idolatry of the otherworldly, and idolatry of beliefs. See, idolatry is just human-centeredness rather than life-centeredness. It's not bowing down to statues. It's not believing in the wrong God. It's human-centeredness. It's anthropocentrism. When we are human-centered, we are causing our own destruction. No species can survive. And this would be true for squids. If squids were the top, and if they had squid-centeredness, they'd be destroying themselves. So we have to be life-centered, and that's what religion, if it's doing its job, is supposed to do, is to help us be life-centered, not human-centered. But that can only happen unless we have if we don't have a trivial, impotent, inconsequential notion of God. If when we use the word God, we meant reality, the biosphere, the ecosphere, then it would be obvious. But that's not the way God language has been used for the last 500 years or longer. So many of us think of God in such trivial ways. You know, God is a supernatural being who resides off the planet and outside the universe, who blesses some and smites others, who's for this football team but not that football team. That kind of an understanding of God is ecocidal, it's suicidal, it's self-destructive. Only an understanding of the divine that is blue, green, and brown can be sustainable. So the role of religion is to ensure that the future is never compromised by the present, and the role of science is to ensure that we have our best understanding of God's evidential word. That is, the way reality is revealing truth evidentially, not just through old men and old books. And then finally, the way of life and the necessity of humility and gratitude. I could say the humility of grief and gratitude as well. Because those of us who are alive and were born into a expanding economy, an expanding society, an expanding civilization, and then we're alive in times when that begins to shift and we're now looking at a decline of civilization, a decline because we've overshot the carrying capacity, that is, we've taken more resources and exuded more waste than the biosystems can handle, so we're starting to now experience the ramifications of that. And some of it is potentially severe, like climate chaos, which could get pretty bad pretty quickly. And the reason we haven't been aware of that is because we haven't understood the way of life. The way of life, let's put it this way. In every sustainable culture, the economy mimics ecology. Economics must mimic ecological wisdom, the wisdom of the biosphere, the wisdom of the living world. See, there's such a thing as God's economy, and what it is, we call it ecology. That is, all resources are recycled as close to 100% as possible, and all energy is conserved as much as possible. Visit any climax ecosystem, any old growth forest anywhere in the world, and that's what you'll find. Species interacting, limiting each other, finding ways to have the least conflict, and all materials are recycled, and all energy is conserved as much as possible. We, because we've been human-centered for about 7,000 or 8,000 years, have been treating the biosphere as just a storehouse for stuff for us and a place for our waste, as if there was an away that we could throw things away. So being sustainable isn't just recycling better. We've got to eventually stop manufacturing plastics. Being sustainable means coming home to the ecology wisdom, the wisdom of ecology. So that's the way of life. We learn this from the living world. And the reason that grief and gratitude are so essential is because all of us that are alive today, if the 20th century was the century of hubris and positive expectations, you know, and I say this with humility, I had a radical shift. The big shift that happened to me since the last time I was here is I was a techno-optimist. I believed when I was here 9 years ago that human history was from the caves to now to the stars. I had a Star Trek vision of the future. I didn't understand energy. I didn't understand ecology. I didn't understand the rise and fall of civilizations. Now that I do understand that, I realize, well, that's not the future. The future isn't simply become ever more energy intensive and wasteful. The future is coming home. I sometimes call it the prodigal species. Yes, we squandered our inheritance, but fortunately we're waking up to our predicament and we're coming home. And there's no shortage of great work to do. That's why the grief, you know, as we learn of species that are going extinct, as we learn in our lifetimes of the damage that's being done, it's important to feel the grief. It's important to actually feel despair. See, a lot of people don't realize that despair is vital. Because again, our instinct is to deny what's uncomfortable, which makes sense, but it also becomes problematic. I love this quote from Stephen Jenkinson. He's a death worker. He says, inattention, not paying attention to the world's ecological state, is well advised. Because attention to it mitigates against your happiness, contentment, and your sense of well-being. Having a conscience now is a grief-soaked proposition. If you awaken in our time, you awaken with a sob. But that's not where I'm going to leave you. That's not what my life is about. It's the gratitude. Because those of us that are alive today, to speak mythically, the universe has you alive today in this amazing, terrifying, unbelievably wonderful, and unbelievably tragic time in human history. And there's no shortage of great work to do. That is work that feeds your soul, that feeds your heart, that nourishes you at the deepest levels, and is a blessing to your community and a blessing to the future. One of the things I've only begun learning about is some of the projects that y'all are doing here in this church that are so exemplary, so positive. And that's what we will do. Is we will be beacons of light in a challenging world. And this is the thing, again, when you understand the shape of time, remember my 3 points? The shape of time and the nature of joy and fulfillment. The color of God and the purpose of science and religion. And the way of life and the necessity of humility and gratitude, grief and gratitude. The gratitude part is finding where your joy and the world's needs intersect and pursuing that and recognizing that we are in a time when in your lifetime you will continue to see conservative values predominate. And so our sacred responsibility for those of us in the liberal religious tradition is to ensure or do everything we can to ensure that the gains, the incredibly important widening of circle and compassion, widening of circle of inclusivity, that those gains pass on into the future, because it won't happen unless there's a group of committed people committed to that happening. It is holy work. It is sacred work. And liberal Christians, Unitarian Universalists, and others who have a heart for peace and justice and sustainability, we get to play in this role. We get the sacred responsibility to be a blessing to the future by how our hearts open with a wider circle of compassion, not just to other humans, but also to other species, and especially compassion for the future. So we begin to downshift our own lives. Stopping eating meat is not going to save the world, but eating less meat is going to help save your soul. Flying less is not going to save the world, but flying less is going to help save your soul. And by soul, I simply mean your inner self. Living more sustainably, using less energy, less water, driving less, composting, recycling, none of those are going to save the world in themselves, but they're going to nourish you, and they're going to build a community that becomes then a model, so that when others in the next year, the next 6 months, the next 2 years, the next 3 years and 4 years, as some of your friends and neighbors are starting to freak out, you've already gotten your heart to the place of understanding the big picture. You know who you are. You know where you are in time and space. You know why you are. You're here to be a blessing to the past and the future. And you know what matters most. That's what leads to a joyous, fulfilling life. Whatever the shape of time, knowing who you are, where you are in time and space, why you are, your obligations to the past and the future, and what matters most. And of course, what matters most are things like love and compassion. What matters most is your legacy. And I'll say more about that at 1 o'clock. Thank you.